House Education Committee for Wednesday, May 4th, 2005 is called into order. And I welcome all of you, I'll bet you're homeschoolers. And it's Apple Pie Day, is that correct? Yahoo, haven't seen the apple pie yet, but I'm sure it's coming.
The staff ate it.
Okay, well then. We welcome you here today. And my apologies that we started 5 minutes late. I tried to make it a point, and that means I owe money into the pot in this committee. We have a little fine and assessment where we're funding education here, and we, for lateness and for cell phones, if you have your cell phone on, turn them off, or for acronyms. So if any of you tempted to use acronyms today, please give us the expanded version before you go into the use of that acronym. So those are the ground rules here. Okay. We're going to begin with a public hearing on House Bill 3178. Mr. Keller, would you give us an overview, please?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 3178 changes the basis of the state fund transportation grant from a percentage of accrued transportation costs of school districts to an amount based on amount received by the school district in the prior year, effective July 1st, 2001. In your packets attached to the staff measure summary is a -2 amendment, and we have since developed a -3 amendment, and Cindy Hunt is here to help walk us through it.
Okay, Ms. Hunt, please.
Good afternoon. Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. The -3 amendments do a couple of things. The major thing that they do is change the basis of the transportation grant for school districts. And the way they do that is you'll see on lines 5 to 7, where now the transportation grant under the amendment would equal a school district's ADM, so the number of students they have, times the amount distributed to the school district as a transportation grant in the prior school year, divided by the amount of students they had in that prior school year. So basically, it's an amount per student. So if their student count goes up, they get more. If it goes down, they get less. But it's always the same per student. The other part that was added is in paragraph B, which talks about the Department of Ed may increase that transportation grant based on the actual fuel costs incurred by a school district. And that would be based on criteria adopted by the State Board of Ed for determining whether the school district needs to receive the increased transportation grant and then the amount of the increase. Then in C, it's kind of a technical section talking about how the calculation, the ongoing calculation of a school district's transportation grant is not affected if they get increased amounts for fuel in 1 year. So that doesn't carry over from year to year. The other thing that the amendments do is delay the implementation of the change to the, let's see, the 2007-2008 school year. And that might be everything the amendments.
Okay, are there any questions for Ms. Hunt? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hunt, is there any changes if a district has students say who a greater amount of students who live farther away or a larger number of students who are disabled and require special transportation or any of those?
Chair Flores, Representative March, there isn't. However, right now, if you are one of those school districts that have in the 90th percentile as far as your transportation grant goes, you get more money based on current law. That would carry over in that bill. So if you're a school district that's getting more per student right now, that carries over into this mechanism. So, for example, I know that many of the school districts who are in the 90th percentile or the 80th percentile currently are from Eastern Oregon, and they have higher distances to travel, and that's why their costs are increased. So that kind of thing would carry over.
Representative Roblin is anxious to hop in there.
Follow up on that one. So
that is a percentile of how much they're paying. And so what right. you're saying is that this isn't just a per student. How does that still figure in?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, the way it figures in is that under current law, most of the school districts get 70% of their actual transportation costs. There's, however, if you're ranked in the between the 80th and the 90th percentile as far as your transportation costs, you get 80%, and then there's a 90%. So because this bill bases the amount per student on the prior school year's amount, how we calculate the amount, in this case it would be for the 06-07 school year, based on current law, carries over. So, for example, if you're a school district in the 06-07 school year that's getting more per student because you're in that 90th percentile, because we're basing it on the amount you're getting per student, that still carries over into this bill.
Well, follow up.
And does that then mean that you will be always in that 90th percentile? It won't change the who's in the 90th percentile ever again?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, you're not exactly in the 90th percentile. However, if you got a higher amount in 06-07,
you would always
that carries over, unless you've had a decrease in enrollment would decrease the amount, for example, or an increase in enrollment would change it as well. And then, of course, the adjustment for fuel costs.
It wouldn't change the amount you're getting, but it would change the total amount you're getting. So those schools that will be institutionally getting a higher rate forever. Now, a higher per student rate.
A higher per student rate.
Right.
Right.
It may change because of the number of students, but
correct.
So as of today, whatever group you're in, mm-hmm. you get to institutionalize that advantage, basically.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. I should also mention, I don't think I explained, is that after the 07-08 school year, the draft also increases the amount a school district gets for that transportation grant by a 4% cost of living increase each year. Mm-hmm. So they do get a little bit more each year.
Okay. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next question would be in a district like ours. So we're decreasing enrollment, so we're going to decrease the amount, but that doesn't take into consideration that the routes may all have to stay the same because the people who leave could have been the ones that live near the school and were walking. So our total number of kids that are taking buses may not change at all, but the amount of money we get to provide the services to those would go down.
Okay. Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, that's correct because it's not based on an actual cost amount anymore.
Mm-hmm. You're clear?
No, I'd like to.
Oh, okay, Representative March.
So follow up on that. How about in the opposite case, for example, because neighborhoods go through evolution and school age populations, if you have a decline in those high cost students in the outer part of your district, and an increase in the local ones, and your actual costs go down, the state doesn't realize any savings in that. Is that correct?
Chair Flores, Representative March.
You have the same number of students.
Yeah, the same number. Yeah,
but your actual transportation costs
right.
have gone down.
Yeah, the amount per student remains the same, whether or not they're a high cost disability student or another traditional student who doesn't need transportation or something like that. But as far as saving the state, I mean, it all comes out of the state school fund. So if less money is going to transportation grant, then more money goes to some of the other grants that come out of the state school fund.
No, you missed the point of the question.
Oh.
If a district's actual transportation costs decline,
mm-hmm.
you're not, but they have the same number of students. The money you're paying them X amount for transportation, mm-hmm. and increasing it by 0.4% every year, even though that cost may have gone down, they're getting the extra money. The state's not realizing any savings on their declining
right.
transportation costs.
Right. Chair Flores, Representative March, that's correct. Any savings that they have is retained by the district.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With this 3187-3, how much do you think we can expect to save transportation cost Do you think we can save it actually through this bill, or it is just a neutral?
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, I'm not sure. I don't have the answer for you about how much you would save. That would be a question maybe for the Legislative Revenue Office or the, you know, school districts.
Madam Chair, do we have the number?
We don't have that number yet, but we will be getting that number and bring the bill back for that information.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay. Good information. Okay. Representative
Dahl? Yes, you pointed out that in Section B, the Department of Ed can increase the amount of money for transportation. I'm assuming that we have an anomaly in a new bus route, a longer bus route. Those are the provisions for increasing the transportation allocation?
Representative Dahlem, The provisions for increasing based on actual fuel costs would be based on the criteria adopted by the State Board of Education. So, and they would be doing that by rule with public hearing and so forth. But they could base it on a variety of criteria. For example, increased fuel costs generally, like we're experiencing right now. It could be perhaps in Eastern Oregon there's a larger fuel cost than in Western Oregon. It could be a variety of factors that the board could take into consideration.
Thank you.
Representative Roebling?
One last question. Along with Representative Lim's question about savings of money, if in fact the state received a savings because of this implementation, does that have any indication that there's actually costing less for districts to provide that service, or is just the state's share would be maybe cut? The concern I have is that all we're doing, if we pass this and it saves the state money, is it incurs more costs to local districts.
Yeah.
Do you see any connection?
Representative Roebling, if in fact less total amount of money is going out for transportation grants under this, yeah, you're correct. I mean, the draft isn't based on actual costs,
right.
So
it just shifts that extra cost to a district. If there's extra cost.
Yeah, if there's extra costs, then the district makes that up. If they have efficiencies, then they get to retain the savings.
Right.
Further questions for Ms. Hunt? Thank you very much. Brian Reeder, please.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, I'm Brian Reeder with the Department of Education. I'm not quite sure how to start here other than saying that...
Pick a point. Pick a point, any point.
It was my understanding that committee staff would work with the Department of Education in drafting these amendments. The department was not given an opportunity to participate in that process. I don't think the amendments are written really very well. I think they're awkward, and the requirement that the state board make rules and base fuel cost adjustments on actual district expenditures on fuel, I think will generate a lot of extra work for the department that is unnecessary. I would have drafted these amendments quite differently. Having said that, I think going back to some of the discussion that has occurred here today, the point of this bill, the only point of this bill, in my mind, was to provide an incentive for districts to be more efficient in their transportation operations by giving them a lump sum of money, and if they are able to run their transportation operations more efficiently, they get to keep the excess money and put it in the classroom. So discussions about savings for the state versus savings for districts, I really think, is irrelevant. What we're talking about here is savings for the system, trying to create some efficiencies in transportation so that those savings can be put in the classroom where they actually benefit students. Beyond that, I don't know what else to say. I would like an opportunity to fix these amendments, to do something that I think is more workable, imposes less administrative burden on the state board and on the department, and it makes this a little more predictable.
Okay, very well. Are there questions for Mr. Rader?
Madam Chair.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rader, I just had a question for you. How many students does an average school bus hold? Do you know the answer to that?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, with your indulgence, I'd like to ask Deborah Lincoln to come up. She's our transportation director. She can answer those sorts of questions far better than I can.
For the record, Deborah Lincoln with the Department of Education. You can get a school bus spec'd in different sizes. Typically, 66 passenger, but many districts are now purchasing them at 72 and even 84 passenger. You also have the smaller size vehicle that's 36, and then a special ed bus frequently goes down as low as 12 that transports wheelchair students. So I don't know that we can just pick a number and say there's an average number of students, but typically a larger size bus would transport between 66 and 84 small size rumps. And we actually measure that 13 inch per rump. That's the standard measurement.
So follow up. So if you had a bus, let's say, that held 72 students, and you only needed to transport, say, 62 students instead of, let's say you had a reduction of 10, it's still going to cost you the same amount of money to operate that bus, essentially. You might not have to make as many stops, but...
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, that's essentially correct. You still have driver salary. You still have fuel maintenance. You're going to travel the same roads. You will save some in the number of stops. But again, that's factoring all high elementary students. If you are transporting an entire bus of high school students, you may not be able to put 72... Probably not. On a bus, you're more like down in the 44.
I have one more question.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much. And did you say your name, Mr. Reed?
Reader.
Reader, okay. Thank you. And you mentioned that this 3178-3 is not written well. Do you have any proposal for amendment on this bill?
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, yes, I think the part of the amendment, Section 8A, I think is appropriate, expressing this on a per ADM basis or some sort of per student basis. But the adjustments described in Sub B and Sub C, I think, could be done much more efficiently by tying the per student grant to an index, a combined index of fuel and labor costs. Now, even though we talked in previous hearings about tying it to fuel costs, need to remember that transportation, the transportation function is still dominated by personnel costs. So, in my mind, it wouldn't be appropriate to tie the entire cost to simply a fuel cost index, but some, for example, a weighted average of a fuel cost index and a wage index, so that you would be capturing both the increase in wages and the increase in fuel. I think that is a much more efficient way to do this adjustment than to have the department try to gather data on the actual fuel costs or fuel expenditures of each individual district and then try to make ad hoc adjustments based on those. The price of fuel, general trends in the price of fuel, are set in world markets, and so they don't vary significantly from one part of the state to another. So there, I don't see any terribly compelling reason to try to do it on a district-by-district basis, but instead tie it to an index, which is readily available and is actually forecast by the state economist office. So it is something we already have and would be very straightforward to do.
Thank you.
Representative
Fallon. Deborah, this question's for you. In the last 10 years, as you've watched transportation budgets come in and paid out money, have you noticed an inflation rate? Is it how are we doing there?
Chair Flores, Representative Dolan, we did some analysis for this committee, I believe, earlier, and one of the things that we found is that transportation was increasing about 4%, which is also what general education is increasing, so it's pretty consistent with the rest of the education field.
Follow up. How many years back did you... would that take us, the 4%? How long has it been consistently 4% in your analysis?
Chair Flores, Representative Dolan, I believe we looked at 4 or 5 years back. It has to do with what data actually exists.
Thank you very much.
Further questions? Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you figure out this number, is this based on... it would be just the reimbursable ones, because if you take athletic trips and those kind of stuff, that's not included in the money that they're going to get money for. Is that correct?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, under current law, that's correct. And the way this bill would work, it would use their reimbursement amount under current law as a starting point. So you're right, it would capture that same sort of definition where it's home to school, school to home, and education-related trips, but not sports and not non-education-related trips.
Okay. A little short follow-up.
Short follow-up.
So currently, would you expect that they've been doing less of the educational field trips than they used to do at one time because of cutbacks in general in education? And so this would institutionalize not doing those? I mean, you wouldn't get any extra money for doing those in the future. Is that correct?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, yeah, to the extent that they cut those back, then you're correct that those expenditures would not be in there and would not be in the base. Now, we could talk about maybe instead of using a particular year as a base, maybe use an average over a number of preceding years or even use a year sometime in the past if it's felt that it would be necessary to try and raise, go back to a time when there were more of those trips occurring if it's your feeling that those financing those trips is an important thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, follow up. The question then goes kind of to Representative Dolan, and that is that we've seen a 4% growth over time, but that does not take into consideration that they may have been choosing to do less in that same period of time, and so the growth was could be attributed to not only increases in costs, but decreases in use of vehicles during that same period of time.
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, that's correct. I would say, though, keep in mind that what we're doing here doesn't, if this bill were to provide a transportation grant to a district, it's not saying you can only spend that much on transportation. They're free to use other resources to do more trips if they choose to. So, as I stated earlier, the point of this is to provide an incentive for them to be more efficient, which the current system really does not provide.
One last.
You're sure?
I am.
Your final answer. Okay.
One last thought. So, as a grant, we get X number of dollars. So, currently, that means that 30% has been coming out of my general fund to provide the other 30%. So, as soon as I know that it's a grant funded, to save money, I could cut routes and do whatever, make people walk farther, and just use the grant money to provide whatever busing I'm going to do, and therefore get efficiencies in the sense that we provide less service, but we're going to get this money. We know we're going to get it, so it doesn't matter what we spend.
Chair Flores, Representative Roland, and that's a valid concern, and that is one of our concerns, is that districts will say, well, I can save money by not transporting as much, and I would view that not as a true efficiency. That's simply a cut in service.
Right.
And in some sense, it's transferring the burden from the district to families. And we do have a concern about that. So, in a lot of ways, that's a local issue. They need to be responsive to their families and their constituents in that regard.
Question.
Representative Dolan.
Deborah, do you have any notion as to how many districts provide portal-to-portal service as opposed to a collection point system, and how many might be able to exercise that option? Any idea?
Chair Flores, Representative Dahlem, when you say portal-to-portal, you mean like a home-to-school,
home-to-school,
rather than...
At the very furthest, at the end of the block, in town, to the front of the school. Any idea?
I'm going to try to answer that in a vague way. If I answer that, please.
I'm going to be satisfied. If you have any answer at all, you're going to surprise me.
I am aware of some locations that use what they call a holding location. So you walk to your neighborhood elementary, and so that's probably a mile and a half. They walk to their elementary, and the bus comes in and picks up a group of kids at like. That's a very efficient way to do that. I would say generally most transportation is done from your home or a local bus stop where you've grouped in an area and picked up and transported to a building or a location.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
I knew I should have called that one out. Representative Bart.
I'll be quick. I was so confused by Representative Dahlem's question. Now I need to ask a follow-up question. When you're talking about the holding locations, because I'm thinking back on when my kids were in elementary school, and it seemed that there was like a neighborhood pickup. So like maybe four blocks would... you know, congregate in two locations, and the bus would just go down the main collector to pick children up. But then your answer confused me further, because then I thought you were saying that the bus went from home to home to pick up children.
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, I thought the question was, what did the most of them do? And I would say, generally, most students are picked up nearby their home. The larger the district, the larger the city, yes, you can use a holding location. I will tell you, though, that those loading situations cause a lot of problems, because you have a group of unattended children standing in somebody's driveway or property, and those kind of situations generate a lot of complaints. Kids fooling around, pushing out in traffic. You'll see more traffic accidents. They fool around, push each other out in traffic. So there's a lot of safety concerns. So the one district that I was speaking about that used schools, they had some supervision because the building principal was there. Again, there's got to be some cooperation between the districts.
Well, I was one of several mothers that was on bus stop duty, so I do understand.
Okay. Representative Dahlem.
Where I was going with all of that, there are a few, and I think it's precious few, but I wasn't sure, districts that go down the street and stop in front of not all homes, but most homes, and the collection spots are one or two kids at a maximum. But that's not widely practiced, and that's where I was going with that. What economy of savings can we see when we ask a district to do collectors or to do some, to do the more efficient forms as opposed to the portal to portal?
Chair Flores, Representative Dahlem, let me just address that issue, that in a rural district, where they're stopping maybe every mile or every two or three houses, it's frustrating as a bus driver to have to stop that often when you want to initiate your lights with enough time. And so you don't want to stop any more than you have to. There are also safety concerns. If there is nowhere for the student to walk, if there aren't sidewalks, there isn't enough shoulder, then you don't want to jeopardize students walking down the road in an unsafe condition. So they probably have to make the stops more frequently for the safety of the student. Parents are also very protective. They want to be able to see their child right at the end of their driveway. So I think school districts generally work very hard at grouping stops as best they can. Again, if you're looking for savings, you're not going to save a lot there, just more frequent stops.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I've never worked so hard.
That's a true false.
Thank you.
I just might make a note to our audience, our viewing audience, this is how these things are fully vetted. They just have to get it out. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions for our panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3178. We will make another go-round at some discussion with the Department of Education to get the amendments crafted along the line of some mutual agreement as far as an incentive and potential in-district savings. Thank you. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2727. Mr. Keller?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2727. It relates to the school lunch program. The last time we heard it was on April 8th. We have a dash one amendment, which effectively replaces the bill. And the amendment reads, each school year, the Department of Education shall notify all school districts about the resources available from the department to assist school districts in operating school breakfast and lunch programs that are self-supporting.
Oh, yikes. Okay. Okay. Mr. Keller has read the dash one amendments, which basically replace the bill and requiring the Department of Education to notify school districts of resources available. We have no one signed up to testify in this bill, so what I will do is close the public hearing. We'll have a work session on it so that we can discuss it. Okay? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2727. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2727. If you want to move the dash one amendments, we'll open up to discussion.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2727.
Okay. Representative Dahlem has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2727. Discussion. Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I note that we're amending ORS 327008. Which discusses the amount of monies appropriated by the Legislative Assembly to fund schools, hopefully at $5.4 million, because I think that's like the bare essential budget level that is needed. Actually, my districts would like 6.1, and we're going to ask the department to go out and notify the districts about these resources available. Are we going to do anything more here? I mean, I really think we need to talk about how much we're going to fund education rather than. I mean, I think the department can do this without this bill. That's what I'm saying.
The scope and purview of this particular bill, Representative March, is not a discussion on the adequacy of the funding level for education. And the scope and purview of this bill is brought to us with the concern that was established early or from the interim that the Department of Education, while it does have resources to notify school districts that might be operating in the red as far as their food services, breakfast and lunch programs, they had not been proactive in that. And we've had some discussions, and I don't see... Oh, yes, I do. Would you like to come forward, and we can have some testimony in that regard. But primarily to encourage that proactive approach as far as approaching districts that are having difficulty in meeting their or operating in the black.
Chairman Flores, for the record, I'm Heidi Dupuy with the Oregon Department of Education. And yes, we do have a staff member on my team with ODE that's dedicated to providing financial management technical assistance. That is his area of expertise. He's been a former food service director in a district here in Oregon, as well as being a private restaurant owner previously. And our approach has been, we have not in the, let's see, I'm going to back up. Prior to 4 years ago, we did not take as an agency a particular interest in the financial status of school lunch programs. And one of Superintendent Susan Castillo's directives to us was what could we do to help school districts put more keep more money in the general fund to be used in the classroom rather than subsidizing the National School Lunch Program. Because we had not been very proactive about that, we put out that we would be able to help districts in helping or making their school food service program self-supporting, and then school districts could request those services from us. And we have had a full agenda every year since then. And we've also been closely monitoring their annual financial reports, and over the last 2 years see that there's a group of school districts who have not come forward themselves yet every year are running in the red. And so this coming year we'll be taking a proactive stance, and that you're running in the red and we are going to provide you with services. So that is the bill as it is written has the potential for increasing our workload, but it's also a service that we're currently providing. So we'll continue to do that.
Representative Stroblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're in work session, so this is just a comment. This is just more of a comment. I get frustrated at times, not very often, I try not to, but when we pass laws that I don't think there's a reason for, and we do those kinds of things, and I think we're doing this now, and so I get frustrated at times, so about just putting more things and saying, you know, micromanaging each one of these departments. There's times when I think we should do away with certain things completely, but when it comes to micromanaging things, I get frustrated sometimes. So I probably will vote no on this. I just have to figure it out.
Very well.
Thanks.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Heidi, because we've had this conversation before, and of course, as the committee knows, I have a bill that is requiring some school districts that didn't currently offer a lunch program to provide lunches to their students. And I know that you're working with those school districts to help implement the program. But that's really primarily what you do, is you work with the individual school districts in helping them implement their lunch program.
Chairman Flores and Representative Farr, that's correct. Along with monitoring to make sure that they're meeting their federal regulations, we also, the other piece that we do is in program development for them to assist them in their actual management and development of the program for the students of Oregon.
Do you, as a department, feel that this is a good bill to move forward?
The department is neutral on the content of the bill.
Follow up. Do you feel that you are adequately addressing the districts in aiding them with the resources that are available to them to implement their program?
Chairman Flores and Representative Farr, yes, I do. Our staff is skilled in doing this, and we do a very complete assessment when we go into the school district and provide them with activities that they can undertake and to come with the desired outcome of, if not erasing the red entirely, moving from tens of thousands of dollars in support to below $10,000 in support. Because we do have small school districts because of where they're placed and the number of, or where they're located and the number of students that they have in enrollment makes it very difficult for them to break even. But we can move them so that it's the least amount going into the program for support as possible. Quite frankly, some of our frustration is that we're just one piece of a very complicated puzzle that people are trying to manage. And when we're there, they're focused on that. And when we leave, their focus turns to other things, and they may not implement what they had discussed with us would be what they were going to implement. And that's where our frustration comes in as an agency.
Follow up.
Do you think this could be a useful tool then for you to open communication with the school districts and encourage them to be an active player with you?
Madam Chair Flores and Representative Farr, I do think that it could serve as that kind of a tool. We do have school districts who would say, I love to invite you to come in to my district and do a financial review, but this person is reluctant. And it could be the food services person that's reluctant. It could be in the school district administration that's reluctant to invite the ODE in to help them do a financial assessment of their program.
Would it be helpful if we sent them each a copy of the proposed amendment to the hospital?
Representative Dahl.
You talked, Heidi, about being called in or helping some schools. Give me a sense of your success rate. Were you called to 10 schools and 8 moved out of the black? Give me some sort of sense of your success rate.
Chairman Flores and Representative Dahlem, right off the top of my head, we've probably been in 60 school districts and have moved probably 8 from the red to the black. One of the most frequent problems that we see is excess labor cost at the school district level. And because we are a state that has labor contracts and has contracted labor, making changes in labor assignments is very challenging at the local level. And the primary method that we use is increasing their revenue sources. So improving their menu so it's appealing to kids, moving their breakfast from a preschool time activity to the first 20 minutes of the school day when this, and we're calling that breakfast in the classroom. And it increases, for one school district, this Pilot Rock went from probably $30,000 in the red to being $10,000 in the black after running it for just 4 months. They've run it for the whole school year, and they will be significantly in the black by the end of the school year just by moving when breakfast was available to kids and making it an integrated part of the school day. And it not only increased in participation in this lunch or breakfast program, but it also, they were able to change the nutrition quality of the breakfast offered.
Okay. I'm sympathetic to Representative Roblin calling ODE into a school's lunch program, but would this help you channel more money into the classroom? Would it be helpful? I'm going to repeat the question because I want to be sure after 8 it would help. Thank you. Alrighty, what are we going to do?
Representative March.
Thank you. Heidi, are you saying then, like currently, even if we fund schools at $5.4 billion, say, that some of these school districts are operating in the red and they have to take funds out of the money intended for the classroom to operate their school lunch program, and shouldn't we fund them at least 5.4 for the
March? Once again, I will tell you, this is not the forum for discussing the adequacy of the school funding level.
Well, I think it's all interconnected, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Did you wish to?
We'll set aside for the moment that 5.4 is a minimum, but what you're saying is now school districts can fund part of their lunch or food programs out of money that we theoretically intend for the classroom.
Right. Chairman Flores and Representative March, accounting principles require that funds be in balance, and so if there's a deficit in the national the school lunch fund, that funds have to come from somewhere to balance that fund. As far as $5.4 billion versus a support that we're figuring based on our most current year, which is the 2002-2003 school year, that school districts subsidized their program above the required USDA match, $1.2 million. So it's not a big amount. We have one school district that has a deficit of around $154,000, and we are currently working actively with them. And then the rest range between $50,000 and can be as low as $100,000.
And when you talk about the USDA requirements, those are federal funds that you're talking about?
No, to participate, Chairman Flores, the USDA match, as with many federal grant programs, requires that the state match to be able to have the program. And so how that works in Oregon is that schools, as part of their state school fund, take part of those dollars and put it into their school food services fund. And it's based on lunch meals, and it works out to a little bit less than 5 cents a meal. And I usually tell school districts to budget for five.
That would be a contribution and not a match. Because if 5 cents from the state, we would get 5 cents from federal. So it's a contribution.
Well, federal's giving us $2.25 for our 5 cent contribution.
Right. Thank you. Representative Roebling?
And you're saying $50,000 is kind of the moderate loss. That's about a teacher per district. So my question is, how many districts are we talking about that are operating in the red, approximately?
Chairman Flores and Representative Roebling, it's about we have 175 of the data that we have been able to assess. There are 69 school districts that are in the red.
And Ms. Dupuy, following that, when you had given us an interim report, there were 166 that were in the red. Is that correct?
Chairman Flores, I'd have to go back and look at that report. That was
my recollection.
Okay. That was from the 2000-2001 school year, and I have, in reviewing those reports, have noticed a change in how they are doing their accounting, not in a negative sense, but in that the 2000-2001, many of them were accounting for their required contribution as a transfer in, as a what would be an indicator for subsidizing the program. And in our review of the 2002-2003, that they were doing that, reporting that as a revenue, which is what it should have been reported as. So there was less transfers in the 2002-2003. And move them out of the deficit status.
Further questions? Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
I was going to withdraw the amendment, but I'm not sure that I want to.
I'd like to discuss that. I concur with Representative Roebling in your statement that I'm not one to want to impose, and Representative March, please duly note this, to impose requirements. But if it's a helpful tool in helping money get to the classroom, I think that is our goal. And of one of those accountability and efficiency pieces, that in the event we are not successful, Representative March, in getting to what would many would consider adequate and some grossly inadequate figure, then this would at least be a tool to help more money be directed to classrooms. So, I'm
good amendment.
Shall we take a vote then?
Yeah.
We're ready to do
I would
that.
Like to take a vote.
Thank you. Those of the opinion that the dash one amendments to House Bill 2727 should be appended, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed, say no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hart?
Aye.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative
Roebling? Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Vester Dahlem?
Aye.
It's the dash ones.
March?
Aye.
Aye. Having received the required majority, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Dahlen.
Madam Chairman, I make a motion that House Bill 2727 be moved to the floor with a do-pass amendment.
As amended?
As amended.
Thank you. Representative Dahlem has moved that House Bill 2727 be forwarded to the floor with a do-pass as amended recommendation. All those who are in favor will signify by saying aye. All of those who are opposed will say no. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Representative
Hill?
No.
Vice
Chair
Dahlen?
Aye.
Vice Chair March?
No.
Aye. Having received the required majority, House Bill 2727 will move to the floor with a do-pass recommendation as amended. Representative Dahlen, would you like to carry the bill?
I will. It's a lunch bill. Would you like? I'll carry it. But
thank you, Vice Chair Dahlem. I would appreciate it. I would love to carry that bill.
Well, we could have co-carriers. How
all right, we'll carry it together.
We will hold hands.
We're just
carry
here
it
to work this out. Thank you very much. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2727. We will be moving next to a public hearing on House Bill 2622. And Mr. Keller, will you please give us an overview?
House Bill 2622 repeals examination requirements that apply to children who are taught by a private teacher, parent, or legal guardian. Allows exemption from compulsory school attendance laws for children taught at direction of parent or legal guardian. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005.
Thank you. I have listed Kevin Sterrett.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Starrett, today on behalf of Home Education Liberty Project, I want to thank you for hearing this, the second hearing on this bill, and Representative Boquist for hearing it, for introducing it. We had testimony in a previous hearing. I don't want to repeat all that. Basically, this bill, as with a similar bill you'll be hearing later, simply recognizes the sanctity of the homeschooling family and the authority of the homeschooling parents. In my home, I am responsible for the feeding and the clothing and the housing and the medical care of my children. When they have to go to the orthodontist, I take them. The state doesn't help or intervene in any way. They don't see to their nutrition or to their pediatrician's bills or anything like that. And since I'm responsible for their curriculum and what they learn, and I know best what they're doing, I think that myself and the other parents who have shown up here today are in the best position to determine when and how their children are tested. And that this bill simply gives the parents of homeschool children the same rights and freedoms that basically the parents of private school children have. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Are there questions for Mr. Starrett? Representative Roblin, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I should have realized.
I know.
I was hurt, but yeah.
I appreciate you coming in. I, as you may or may not, I was a principal, and I appreciated the homeschool parents. I had a very good relationship with a number who used our school in different ways, and I think that is a very positive thing. And many of them would come to me and talk about situations where people shouldn't be homeschooling. I mean, there is a very credible group of homeschool people that I have known and I respect a lot. I get concerned about some people who do it for the wrong reasons, and therefore, without having some way of knowing sometimes that those people should be making sure that their kids get an education. Can you have any ideas about how we can deal with that kind of situation?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, there are so many things in the life of a child that are more fundamental to their very existence than their education. I don't mean to sound heretical, but they need to be fed, they need to be clothed. When they have chicken pox, they need to see a doctor. And there will always be parents who don't do those jobs very well. And the assessments of their educational skills don't really address that. There are other methods for addressing that. And what our position has been is that the people you see here today are not an anomaly. These are what we know most homeschoolers are like. But it is just our position that it is not the job of the state to do this, and I'm well aware of the public school, the mandatory public school laws we have, but if my children are being neglected in any way, in any of a thousand different ways, no one from the state comes and unless there's a question of abuse or neglect that's been reported, nobody decides whether or not I'm giving my children enough vegetables or if their rooms are clean enough or any one of many other things. And while we don't want to see any child fall behind, we also recognize that the whole public school model has one underlying reality, is that it treats every single kid like they're exactly the same. And we don't think that works. And in my two children, I have two young boys, they are so different from each other that they really need, they need different outlets, they need different educations, and they need different assessments. And I'm the person best suited to make those decisions. And if a child is not getting the education that the state decides it wants to get, it wants that child to get, that's no different for me than having the state forget to or not come in and determine whether or not they're being fed properly. And if there's an imperfect homeschooling situation going on, and until it rises to the point where someone can make a legitimate claim of abuse or neglect, for which we have processes to deal with that, we believe that it is in the best interest of the child to have the parents make those decisions. And that educational assessments don't really address what the concerns that we've heard. When this bill was around last session, we were accused by a representative of the superintendent's office of being drug dealers who were keeping our kids out of school because we didn't want anyone to know that we were all growing pot. And quite frankly, if we were growing pot, you know, the market is not amongst the homeschoolers anyway. So the concerns that we've heard and the accusations that have been made don't really address the fundamental issue that if I'm not doing a good job teaching my child algebra, why is that any more the business of state intrusion than if I'm not bathing him frequently enough and all the other things that, especially as a younger child, are far more critical to their well-being than their how far they've advanced in physics or geometry? It just, our position is that it just isn't the role of the government, in the same way that there isn't an assessment of private school students. And if, or no mandatory assessment of private school students, and if those children are not being abused and neglected, then we shouldn't be treated any differently. I mean, there will always be those children who don't do well and don't thrive because, I mean, frankly, as you all know, there are some people who shouldn't have children under any circumstances. And those people very often have their children in public schools, and they're not benefiting from that at all. Bad parents are going to be bad parents. And if there's an issue where a child is really being hurt or neglected, we have the means to address that.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You addressed it kind of at the beginning, and that is the compulsory attendance laws. And you know, this issue about the state's right to student education did go to the Supreme Court through a case from Oregon, actually, and it came back that yes, there is a real interest in society's interest in all of the children of the state that they be educated, and then they gave some exceptions, one of which was homeschool, which I believe in. I think that most homeschoolers do a great job with that. And then they put in a limited testing thing, and the level at which they have to raise is pretty low on those tests. In fact, I have not known any homeschooler that I would deem a person that really is doing it for the right reasons, the reasons you just expressed, who hasn't passed that test. Is there anyone that has ever failed? I cannot. I've never seen one.
Representative Flores, Chairman Flores. But ultimately, it's still a question of the case that you mentioned, the Supreme Court case, specifically gave parents the authority over their children. And ultimately, what it still comes down to me is that these children are mine. These children belong to their parents until they're of an age to go out and be on their own. And any mandatory assessment by the government completely ignores the fact that the government hasn't designed the curriculum, the government doesn't know what my children are learning, and that the tests are, as you kind of just pointed out, in many respects, kind of meaningless.
Any further questions? And no follow-up?
Well, I could have, but I'm okay.
Oh.
Okay. And I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Surratt. Is there anyone else who wished to give testimony on House Bill 2622? Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2622. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2733. Mr. Keller, please.
House Bill 2733 repeals examination requirements that apply to children who are taught by private teacher, parent, or legal guardian, allows exemption from compulsory school attendance laws for children taught at the direction of parent or legal guardian. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005.
Thank you very much. I'll call Lori Wimmer Whalen, and then after that, I'm going to call you in clusters. So, be prepared.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association and its 43,000 members. It was my hope today to speak more generally about all three of the homeschool bills before you, if that would be all right with you, but specifically about this one as well. With respect to House Bill 2733, we have traditionally as an association been very cautious and concerned about removing what we consider to be the very minimal requirements for homeschooling on the grounds that we believe the state has an interest in ensuring the educational safety of all children in Oregon to some extent. Now, the point has been made in past years, and it's a legitimate point, that in private school situations, there isn't a testing requirement. But we would argue that that only argues for making sure that that same standard that applies to public education and to homeschool education also ought to apply to private education, rather than going the other direction and simply removing this very basic minimum standard. Now, I should disclose to you that for a year I was a homeschool parent. My son was homeschooled by my husband when he was having a tough time in middle school. And so I really feel as though I understand exactly what the burdens, minimal though they may be, are on homeschooling families. So I kind of have that hat, too, as I come before you. And I really feel that making an argument that a level of government intervention that is so minimal as Oregon's is kind of stretching the case. I was shocked to find how little Oregon expects of its parents. I will also tell you that I have enormous appreciation for the vast majority of homeschooling families, because I think they do a remarkable job and make a level of commitment that is so high level, and it's clear that their kids are doing just terrific. I was enjoying the performances in the gallery today with some of the young musicians, with Representative Farr this morning, as a matter of fact, and they were just really wonderful, and I commend them all. But as we know, our laws are never written for the best case scenario. They are always written for the lowest common denominator, and there are families out there who are simply absent when it comes to providing a consistent form of parenting or educating in any regard. And that's why I go back to my initial statement that the Oregon Education Association really does feel that the state has an interest in ensuring some minimal level of standard. Now, with the test, four times in a school career, I don't think is hugely burdensome. But with a test, that has diagnostic value. It's not meant to be punitive, but it does give a red flag. If students are struggling in the home environment, there may be a way for professionals to intervene and help that child. I can tell you in my son's middle school, once he went back into school, there was a young girl who was 9 years old who came back into the system as a result of that testing. And at age 9, she couldn't even write her own name. She was not able to perform. She couldn't read. She couldn't write. She couldn't do math. And she was tested. There were no evident learning difficulties in terms of organic problems. And so the school had to, of course, expend enormous resources to try to help intervene and bring this child back up. And I think that she's doing nicely now. But, coming into the school system of a magnet school that is a high science math functioning school and having to slow it down and particularly provide interventions at that kind of level was a difficult burden for that school. But, of course, public education is for all comers. And so they, of course, did that. I bring up that example only to show you that when you have so many fine examples of kids thriving in homeschool, it's easy to have a difficult time imagining what the other side of that coin might be. And so I bring up that illustration to let you know that there are those rare examples, the very low end of the scale and the rare cases. But that is, again, why we have laws. So, most parents don't abuse their children either, but that certainly wouldn't be an argument to repeal our child abuse laws. And so for that reason, we would urge you not to pass these bills relating to the repealing of the testing requirement. We think it is a very minimal level of expectation to come in occasionally and just make sure that kids are on track at some minimal level. And who can argue that a one-on-one Socratic education isn't going to be effective if you put some effort into it at all? I mean, obviously, homeschooling, if you have a one-on-one or a one-on-two relationship, is easier than having 30 kids of all ability levels and maybe some 60 different languages spoken in the home, as the Portland Public Schools do, for example. Obviously, that's a much greater challenge to try to bring kids up at a fast pace. And so comparing public school to homeschooling is another thing that we have some concern over, and we would caution you, as testimony may come before you today, that that's probably not a very good comparator. And I did want to, if I may be indulged, also comment on the bill that you will be hearing today regarding the tax credit. Is that all right, Madam Chair?
We'll just open a public hearing on House Bill 2653 to run concurrently.
Thank you so much. I'm referring to House Bill 2653, and I would point out to you that in Oregon we already give about 57 cents of every tax dollar we levy away in various forms of tax breaks and giveaways. And we are certainly in a critical state right now as a state with respect to our financing of public schools and other vital services, and we'd hate to see another tax credit given for any cause, however worthy, when we're having such a struggle keeping the services afloat that Oregonians are deeming vital. And furthermore, I would point out to you that on line 13 of page 1, the credit of up to $1,000 a year is given to any family that has their child homeschooled for at least 3 months during the tax year. I would, if this law were in effect, and everybody I know who has their kids in school 9 months of the year in public school would make sure that that summer enrichment program we offer at school qualifies us for that $1,000 tax credit, wouldn't you? I mean, it's a loophole that summer programs of every public school students would then, those families would qualify. So it seems to me that perhaps that's just a scrivener's error. But a three-month limitation seems to be overly generous with respect to a tax credit that could cost hundreds of millions of dollars to the state, and we would respectfully oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from Ms. Whalen?
I have a question.
Representative Lim.
And should I go 2653 first, or should I go to the 2733.
You be the judge.
I would be the judge. Okay. First question then, 2733, concerning the homeschoolers. Under the current system, under the program of CM, initial mastery things, how many tests do they have now at this time?
Madam Chair and Representative Lim, it's not my expertise, but I believe it's 3rd, 5th, 8th, 10th, and then once the CAM comes into effect, I think you would have the CAM as well.
Okay. And a follow-up question?
Follow-up.
Currently, as I understand it, they have four examinations for the homeschoolers. And Is it possible your support and your thought if instead of 4 could be reduced to 2? Do you think that's more amicable for you to accept?
Madam Chair and Representative Lim, I think 4 tests over a 12-year course of someone's educational experience is pretty minimal as it is. Our goal, however, is not how many tests, but making sure that occasionally it is possible for the state to ensure that kids are getting an education. And however that best be drafted, we would try to find a way to be supportive. I'm not sure 2 tests is enough to ensure that, but I'm not sure 4 is.
It's better than none, though.
I acknowledge that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Representative March, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And you kind of alluded to the issue of potential child abuse in some homes, and we both agree that probably 99.9% of the homeschooled families are doing, you know, right by their children. But there is that 0.1% or less, whatever it is, out there. And there was a kind of the discussion around testing and also private schools, and certainly I can understand private schools maybe should test, but I was just looking up under the child abuse reporting that school officials, and that includes private schools, are required reporters or mandatory reporters under the law. And there's no requirement, of course, for homes under homeschooling. So the testing might be the only opportunity for the outside world to have any contact with this child. Is that a possibility?
Madam Chair, Representative March, that's very much a possibility. And as a matter of fact, registration and testing are kind of proxies for touch points with something outside the home environment where a child might disclose. And there's certainly other potential touch points, but that might be a time when a child would disclose. But I think more often we're also talking about sheer neglect, the possibility of truancy, and a parent so wrapped up in their own dysfunctions that they're just not parenting. They're just not being parents. And using the homeschool excuse as a way out. You tend to notice if the kids don't take the test when they're required, it's not even the score sometimes, it's the fact that this is a family in dysfunction, and this would be one way to diagnose that.
Thank you.
Representative Gall.
With the tests, if a homeschooler presents themselves at the ESD and takes the test and does not pass this test, then what happens?
Madam Chair and Representative Dahl, my understanding is they had the opportunity to go back and improve their performance in their homeschooling and then test again. If I remember correctly, and it's been a while since I've looked at the statute, it's a long time before the state says you've got to come back into the system. And the test is pretty minimal. I think you have to exceed the bottom 15 percentile to be in the danger zone. So it is a minimal level of requirement. As I said, I don't see it as terribly burdensome. In fact, I was fairly shocked as a parent that there was no, that there wasn't more of a prescriptive level of at least suggestive curriculum material or course of study or curriculum or anything.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the question and the answer. I'm probably outside the parameter of your expertise, but across the state of Oregon in any given year, do you have any notion how many homeschoolers fell into this 15% and below category?
Madam Chair and Representative Dahlem, I don't know. I think that would be a question better asked of the Department of Education. I think they might have that information.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wimmer-Whalen. Representative Lim, since we have a public hearing open on House Bill 2653, I'm presuming that that would be the purpose of your address.
That's right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, and my name is John Lim, a state representative from District 50, which is Gresham area. Thank you very much for hearing the bill I sponsored, which is House Bill 2653. When I was elected to the state Senate in 1993, at the time I heard the homeschoolers were about around 10,000 at the time. As I checked it, a current number, how many homeschoolers, I found out it's about 25,000. It could be 25,000. And then including and 5 and 6 years old, it could be more higher. The point I'm trying to say, there are a growing number of the parents and they are homeschooling of their children in their home. They are not satisfied the current that education system, the way it teaches, and the plus many other core American values continually chipping away. This is the time we look at the policy, why so many parents getting out of a public school and teaching their children in their home. There should be a reason for that. I think I know and you know that many parents and students, and they know why they are doing it. Simple reason is to give them a better education and teach them the value what we hold our country most valuable in the past. As I was walking door to door last election, which was around September and October, I met a lot of parents, homeschoolers. And I began to understand more, while they are paying their property taxes, income taxes, many other taxes, they are not getting any return when they are educating their children in their home. Out of that concern and thought, I thought it is most appropriate and fair way to give them some kind of a tax credit. I thought this $1,000 is the minimum, since when we're educating our children, we are giving them at least $8,000 to $10,000 a year, including state, local, federal tax together. And giving them at least 10% of this amount, I believe it is sending message. We are appreciating their parents. They are teaching their children in their home. Today, we have discussed the transportation issues, how much will it cost to transport our children from to school, and then homeschoolers, we don't have to pay them any transportation cost. We don't have to pay them any breakfast, any lunches, or any others. All that the parents are taking care of all this problem. Do you believe this is fair? At least we give them some kind of a tax credit, such as books, such as a basic necessity to some, some kind of a tools to teach them properly in their school. As the information I have, homeschoolers, they are far exceeding the grade from the public school education. At least 20 to 30%, they are grade higher than public school. That means the parents of the homeschoolers, they are doing a good job. I'm not talking about 100%, I'm talking about in a general sense. So it is most appropriate and proper that we give them as an appreciation that 10,000, not 10, I like to give 10,000, but
they would too.
Okay, at least give them $1,000. I think it's a tactical mistake in this bill, said just 3 months homeschooling. I think it should be at least 6 months or 9 months instead of 3 months. I'm willing to make that amendment. With that, I'm open to questions if you have any questions.
Thank you, Representative Lim. Are there questions?
Okay, you'd like to add anything?
I have to.
You do have, okay.
Well, shall we hear from, did you have some comments you would like to make?
No, for the record. For the record, I'm Seth Hatmaker, legislative assistant, State Representative Lim. I was actually here because I did a lot of the research on the bill, and just in case I had any questions on numbers or research or whatever. So.
Thank you. Representative Roland.
Well, I just stepped out of the room to talk to a group of
and we passed the bill, so what do you expect?
And I missed it. That's okay. But, to a group of homeschooling students from my community, who, and actually I know a number of their parents, and a question came up, and I just wanted to ask you this. When, and it's not exactly to this one, but it could be a part of the tax credit issue, the testing that we do on the other previous bill, are the parents required to pay for the testing?
and plus paperwork.
Right. And does this in here provide credit for that testing?
It doesn't specify that, but it could be.
I mean, I think that's one place in which, you know, if we're requiring the testing, I think it should be paying for it. So I'm not sure that I agree entirely with the credit, but I think that if we're going to have testing.
If I could get your support in putting that amendment, I'm willing to do that.
Yeah, I'll put that one. We can talk about that one.
You can take it out in the hall. Is what
okay.
You can do. Further questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I think with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2653, and there will be amendments that will be crafted and brought back to us. So we are still in a public hearing in House Bill 2733. So now we begin. Mr. Pulliam, are you here? There, would you like to come forward? Who is going to be bringing a message from Senator Bruce Starr, and then we'll swing into the rest of y'all.
Chair Flores, members of the House Education Committee, for the record, my name is Stan Pulliam, and I serve as a legislative assistant for State Senator Bruce Starr, and I'm here to read testimony for Senator Starr. Before I explain the merits of House Bill 2733, I think it's appropriate to provide a short explanation of the history of homeschool laws in Oregon. It used to be prior to 1985 that a parent had to receive permission from the district superintendent to homeschool their child. These decisions by the superintendents were subjective and sometimes political. In 1985, the legislature changed the law working with homeschool advocates. In exchange for getting rid of permission provided by the district superintendent, homeschool families agreed to a notification and annual testing of their children. If students didn't meet specific percentile in these tests, there was a process where the child could be remanded and put back into the public school system. After 14 years of living under annual tests and having a great track record of results, we changed the law again to only require testing in grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. This further recognized the great work that families are doing by accepting the responsibility to educate their own children rather than delegate that responsibility to others. That brings us to today and House Bill 2733. Now, you have a lot of people to listen to testify, so I'm just going to cut it a little bit short. Basically, what I do in my written testimony, which is submitted to all of you, is give a brief summary of some of the three changes that are implemented in the Oregon law pertaining to homeschooling in House Bill 2733. One thing that I believe should be noted is that and which has been noted earlier, is that private schools are in no way have to undergo the testing requirements that are done by homeschooling. And what this bill would essentially do is even the playing field between the two sectors. In closing, it is time that we pass this legislation through the legislature and have it signed by the governor. This bill has 31 sponsors from the Legislative Assembly, strongly representing both parties. It's a bipartisan bill that shows the broad support that the homeschooling community has garnered in this building. Let's pass this bill and send a message to the governor that it's time to start treating the homeschooling community with the respect the community deserves. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Pulliam?
One question.
Representative Lynn.
Yes, thank you very much. Since you discussed in your discussion presentation and you send a strong message to the governor, mm-hmm. Anyone else were able to talk to the governor's office where the governor stands on this issue?
Well, I know that a very similar bill that passed through the legislature in this last 2003 session was vetoed by the governor. There's been repeated attempts to negotiate with the governor. You'll hear from Roger Williams with Ocean, who will be testifying a little bit later. And he has had several conversations with the governor's office, and we're still in hopes to reach a compromise on this bill.
Right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Dorothy Carmen and Amy Grant.
Good Chairman Flores, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dorothy Carmen. I'm on the board of the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network. And the acronym for that, in case I use it in the future, is OCEAN Network. Thank you very much. I send you greetings from the home educators packing out the overflow rooms in DNC. We had over 150 watching on the television, too. I think maybe some of them have had to leave since the hearing began, but we have many homeschoolers, as you notice, and tripped over probably today in the legislature.
We're happy and that you're all here.
Thank you. 20 years of state oversight and testing in Oregon, as Senator Starr's aide gave you the overview of the history of the homeschool bill, and I appreciated that. But we have had 20 years of testing in Oregon, and it has shown clearly that home education is a highly effective educational alternative that produces sound results. Acknowledging this success, House Bill 2733 places home education on a par with other private education in Oregon by removing mandatory notification and testing requirements. And it has been mentioned several times today that private schools do not have to submit tests to the state. I also submit to you that private school parents do not even need to tell anybody that they're pulling their child out of public school and putting them in a private school. Home education is a form of private education, not public education. Oregon currently does not regulate private schools. Oregon should not be regulating home schools. Home schools are the privatest of private schools. And we shouldn't really be under the authority of the superintendent of public instruction. Second point I'd like to make is that standardized tests don't measure individual education, and home education is very individualized, tailor-made education. For the last 20 years, as you heard in previous testimony, homeschool students have tested and have submitted test scores that are 30% percentile points on an average above classroom students. It's time to stop requiring home educators to prove that homeschooling works. We have a track record. We know that homeschooling works. Home educators bear the financial burden for their children's education, including testing. And this burden of providing for our children's own education saves the state, we were guessing, around $137 million because we were estimating about $6,500 per student. But with Representative Lim's more informed, I'm sure, estimate of $10,000 per student, we end up saving the state over $200,000 a year at a minimum if there's 20,000 home $200 million a year if there are 20,000 homeschoolers out there. And then the point I'd like to make about testing is it's not only burdensome, but it really is pointless. It's pointless for the homeschool families. Yes, they do provide some diagnostic reports with the tests. We do get those. But they tell me that my student doesn't know how to spell, perhaps. I know my student doesn't know how to spell. I already know that. They may tell me that they haven't figured out how to do long division. I know that. I'm with my student every day. Standardized achievement tests are for assessing groups of students to see how the educational method works. That's why they were designed. That's how they're used in the No Child Left Behind Act. They're used to assess a school or a classroom to see how that school is performing. They are not and never were designed to measure individual achievement. In fact, there used to be a law in Oregon, I don't know if it's still in effect, but it said that in the classroom, the standardized achievement test could not be used in the student's record as far as evaluating the student's progress. The testing is pointless as far as the state is concerned, and I've heard several testimonies today on the fact that the state can catch homeschool students through this testing. At least there's some touch point or accountability points. Well, in 1999, which was the last year that we had to submit standard annual testing, the law was changed in 1999 so that we're testing in grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. And to be quite frank, the Department of Education has not published complete records of how the homeschool students have done since then. So 1999 is the last year that we had results from annual achievement tests, and those are published on the Oregon Department of Education's website. ESDs, to whom we are responsible, in 1999, used the test to identify 5 students which they required to be returned to the classroom. 5 out of, at that time, probably 15,000 students. And this was at the expense of all the record keeping and staff at the ESD level that has to take in our letters of intent and take in the test results. So we were estimating someplace it cost the state probably about $500,000 to monitor home educators through the ESD personnel. And to be honest, the catch rate is very, very low. Many families who end up putting their children back in public school don't need the test to tell them that their child is struggling. They know their mom is or dad is with them every day and having difficulties teaching them, so they would perhaps put them back in public school. But even more than that, we see, I'm getting calls all the time of families for whom the public school is not meeting the needs of their children, and so they're calling me desperately to say, what can I do to help my child's education? So basically the shoe is on both feet here. There are some educational venues that don't work. In fact, all educational venues don't work in some cases. So there are some public school students that need to come home so they can get the private Socratic instruction methods. And there are some homeschool students that need to go to the public schools. There's no 100% guarantee education anywhere, as I know you've struggled with in other bills that you've faced. House Bill 2733, as mentioned, removes both notification and testing requirements for homeschools, making the homeschool exemption from compulsory attendance laws similar to the requirements for private schools. These changes are in keeping with the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions regarding parental rights to direct their children's education. And I've listed a number of them before, but Representative Roblin brought up Peers for Society Sisters. And in that, the court did recognize that the state does have an interest in the child's education. However, the court went on to say, the fundamental theory of liberty upon which all governments in this union repose excluded any general power of the state to standardize its children by forcing them to accept instruction from public teachers only. And, of course, as a parent, I love the next part of this. The child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right and the high duty to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. I have quoted a number of other Supreme Court rulings that help support the right of parents to direct their children's education. I'll leave those for you to read. I also want to point out that the Oregon legislature has affirmed basic principles of parents' rights, and they're enumerated in ORS 419B.0903. And basically, it says it's the policy of the state of Oregon to guard the liberty interests of parents protected by the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution, and I'll skip on down, with respect to interference with the rights of the parents to direct the upbringing of their children, including but not limited to guide the secular and religious education of their children. So this body has already recognized the right of parents to direct their children's education. Now I want to address the No Child Left Behind issue, because that is often brought up. Doesn't No Child Left Behind require the state to be responsible for every child? And the answer is frankly no. There are several amendments to the No Child Left Behind Act that specifically say that private schools and homeschools are exempt from No Child Left Behind provisions. So you don't have to feel burdened to monitor our children because of the No Child Left Behind provisions. And then the question comes up frequently, already come up several times, what about the parents who are not acting responsibly? I would like to quote the U.S. Supreme Court in Parham versus J.R., that some parents may at times be acting against the interests of their children creates a basis for caution, but is hardly reason to discard wholesale those pages of human experience that teach that parents generally do act in the child's best interest. the statist notion that governmental power should supersede parental authority in all cases because some parents abuse and neglect children is repugnant to American tradition. Clearly, the U.S. Supreme Court continues to uphold the right of parents to direct the upbringing of their children's education, including the right to direct their children's education. In summary, home educators in Oregon are asking this legislature to recognize that homeschools are not public schools by enacting House Bill 2733. Since the 1985 law was enacted, home educators in Oregon have demonstrated that home education works very well. This method of education more than meets the state's compelling interests in children's education. And thankfully, we have Dr. Brian Ray here from the National Center of Home Education Research to give you some more research data on that. Now, home educators would like equity with parents that choose private schools in Oregon. Home education freedom works. Please vote for House Bill 2733.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Amy Grant, and I'm with the Oregon Home Education Network, or OHEN. I'd like to specifically focus on the question of children falling through the cracks, because this came up a number of times last session, and it has come up several times already. I'd like to look at who are these children that are falling through the cracks? Why are they falling through the cracks, and how do we help them? And does the current law do anything to help these children? Well, first of all, the children that are most at risk for abuse and neglect are ages zero, birth to seven. Twice as many children are reported for have reports of abuse and neglect between the ages of 0 and 7 as the ages 8 to 15, which are the ages that are covered by the current state oversight of home education. So the children that are most at risk are the ones that are below the age that the state looks in on homeschoolers. The children that are most at risk are those with parents who are not functioning, either because of chemical abuse, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, because of mental illness, because of some stress in their family. Children with strong families do well. Children that have parents that are not functioning well are the ones that are at risk. Children, parents that are not functioning well are the ones that are least likely to homeschool because homeschooling is hard. It's a major commitment. It's a major commitment of your time. It's a major commitment of resources. Parents that don't want to deal with their children would rather have the children away from the house between 8 a.m. and 3 p.m. every day. Parents that are not functioning well are also, even if they do choose to homeschool, are the least likely to comply with home education oversight laws. They are the least likely. Some examples were brought up last session of, well, what about the marijuana-growing family? What about the meth-abusing family? My suggestion is that the marijuana-growing family is not going to be registering and testing their child, and the meth-abusing family is not going to be registering and testing their child. And standardized tests aren't going to help those kids. Our criminal laws and our child welfare laws are going to help those kids. So I'd like you to think in terms of the children that are falling through the cracks. Let's help them. Let's provide the resources that we need. Let's provide mental health coverage. Let's provide, you know, access to affordable health care. Let's provide drug abuse treatment. Let's help the cause of the kids that are falling through the cracks. Giving them a fill-in-the-bubble standardized test is not going to help those children. I can speak from experience of being raised by an alcoholic mother that I scored very, very well on standardized tests. There was nothing in my school record that would show what was going on at home. I know from personal experience friends that were abused as children. They did very, very well in school, in part out of fear. So a standardized test is not going to identify children that may be abused or children at risk. We need to help their parents. We need strong families. We need resources for those parents.
There also have been questions about truants masquerading as homeschoolers, and this seems to come up every session, that there are some kids that drop out of high school that claim to be homeschooling and register as homeschoolers, but aren't really doing anything, aren't getting an education. Well, the data from the Department of Education shows that if this is a problem, it is a very, very, very small problem. There were, for the class of 2003, 17.4% dropped out. That was 8,217 students. 0.6% left high school to homeschool. That was 307 students. So if there were, in fact, truants that were masquerading as homeschoolers, that registered as homeschoolers but aren't doing anything, they're in that 307 number. There are about 11,000 other students that did not receive a high school education that the state knows about. I think to focus on some small percentage of 307 students that left high school to homeschool and claim that that's where the problem is just diverting attention from where the real problem is, where the state knows the problem is, the kids that are dropping out. And if you want to reach those kids, provide the incentive to them, provide gateway to college that PCC offers, provide them a means to catch up, provide them a means to get some vocational education, help the kids that have dropped out. Don't focus on some unknown percentage of 307 students that are homeschooling. I'd like to talk a little bit about the mechanisms for reporting abuse and neglect. Somebody brought up that school officials are required, are mandatory reporters. I am also a mandatory reporter because I'm a Girl Scout leader. There are a lot of people who are mandatory reporters. In fact, 83% of the reports of child abuse and child neglect came from sources other than education and child care providers. 83% came from either community members, family, friends, church members, Girl Scout leaders. It came from other professional sources, doctors, counselors, law enforcement. The other interesting thing is that all of those other sources had a quality, the quality of the reports, the rate at which those reports were substantiated was as high or higher than the reports that did come from the education sources. So there are mechanisms to identify child abuse and children at risk of child abuse and child neglect. They don't have to go to school to do that. There are lots and lots of sources for that kind of oversight. In a report, in a survey that Dr. Ray did, it showed that on average, homeschooled kids participate in 5.9 outside activities. 98% of homeschoolers that were surveyed participate in more than 2 outside activities. So our kids are not sitting at home with just mom and dad. They are out in the community. My belief is that homeschool kids actually interact with more adults on an ongoing basis than children in the classroom do. I know that my daughter sees a French teacher, she sees a computer animation teacher, she sees her fencing coach, she sees the Girl Scout troop, she sees the people that all the families that she coaches their kids. They're out there in the community. They're interacting with the librarians. They're doing volunteer work. They're doing 4-H. Homeschoolers are out in the world. And so if there is, they are, in fact, talking with lots of people. If there is a problem, there are many, many people in the community that can help identify that. I'd like to talk a little bit about standardized tests as a diagnostic tool. As Mrs. Carmen mentioned, standardized tests were designed to compartmentalize groups of students. They were designed to create a bell curve of results. Nationally North standardized tests are created so that there's, you know, a nice curve, and it's designed around some general base of knowledge. Well, in second grade, my daughter took an interest in ancient Egypt. She didn't care about My Friend the Fireman. She wanted to learn what was going on thousands of years ago. So
if she had had to be tested on social studies that year, she wouldn't be answering questions about my... I mean, she wouldn't be prepared to answer whatever questions were covered in the normal second grade curriculum. She was interested in ancient history. My son, at age 5, was interested in lasers. He also happens to be dyslexic. So he didn't read fluently until he was 11 or 12. And yet I could see the educational progress that was happening with him, and I could work with him to make sure that that progress was happening on his timetable and in his method. And I could adapt how I was working with him and what materials we used and what skills he developed. I could adapt them to his needs. He probably would have been below the 15th percentile in reading in third grade had I had him tested. I wasn't going to subject him to that. That would have been a very detrimental experience for him. It would have degraded his self-image, his self-esteem. It would have made him feel like a failure when I knew that he was making really good progress. So I'd like to suggest that standardized testing not only in many cases is simply inapplicable to an individualized education. In some cases, it is harmful. I think maybe Roger Williams will talk about the fact that he spent many years changing the way that he was working with his child. Instead of giving the child the help that he really needed, he was teaching to the test so that his child would score above the 15th percentile. Yeah, this is education at its worst. This is why, you know, one of the reasons that we home educate is so we can tailor our approach and our education to each child's needs. And standardized testing is a really bad fit for many children that have learning differences. Some families love standardized testing and do it every year, and I say more power to them. If they gain some knowledge from that, that's wonderful. But that's their choice. That should be their choice. That should not be something that is mandated by the state. I'd like to remind you that there is, in fact, a distinction between private education and public education. And home education is private education. I'd like to touch on just a couple of other points that were brought up. Laws are written for the lowest common denominator. By that rationale, I would expect that we would be passing laws requiring parents to submit meal plans. It seems to me that nutrition for children is at least as important as whether they are at grade level in their reading skills or whether it's going to take them an extra couple of years. And yet, even though there are some families that feed their children junk food or unhealthy food or no food, you know, we don't require state oversight of those parents. We wait until there's something wrong, and then we address it. That's what social services are for. I'd like to talk a little bit about the anecdote that has been raised repeatedly about the child that couldn't write her name. My son has very limited writing skills at this point. He is a very strong reader. He's very, very strong in math and physics. And writing is coming along. If I were to put him back in school right now, yes, absolutely, he would need some help. You know what? Every day there are children entering the school system, either from another country or from another school system or another state, that need some sort of catch-up help. This is not an exclusive purview. I think if you asked the majority of educators, where is the majority of intervention that you have to do? Where are the resources of the schools being used in bringing kids up to speed? I seriously doubt that you're going to hear that the majority of the cases are homeschoolers that are reentering. I think you're going to hear that it's language issues. So to say that one child that couldn't write is a condemnation of 20,000 homeschoolers is just unfair. The state has now had 6 years of reduced testing. We went from annual testing to every 4 years. I have yet to see a rash of homeschoolers that are turning out as ignoramuses because we are testing less. Testing does not drive education. Parents drive education, and parents' freedom to tailor their children's education to fit the child's needs drives education. So I would suggest that the state provide some sort of evidence that lessened testing has made any difference at all. I'm going to say it doesn't. And you know what? No testing at all is not going to make any difference, because testing doesn't create the education. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Representative Farr.
I just have a question. I'm not sure that you can answer this, but let me just go to the bill, because I was reading through the bill as you were talking. And if I'm reading it correctly, for a homeschooled student to participate in classes in the public education system, interscholastic activities, they do still need to achieve a minimum score on a nationally normed standardized achievement test.
Yes, that is the same as under current laws, which says if you want to participate in a public school interscholastic activity, such as sports or speech or one of the other OSAA activities, you have to play by the rules. You have to play by the same rules as children in the school. And children in the school have to meet a certain grade point average, so homeschoolers have to establish an equivalent to that grade point average.
So, in essence, what the bill is stating is that in order for you to participate, or your students to participate, you still have to comply with the testing requirement.
If that's the same thing as under the current law. Even under the current law, where homeschoolers test four times, if they want to participate in interscholastic activities, they have to qualify annually.
So I'm sorry, maybe you don't understand my question.
No.
My question is, if you don't comply with the testing requirement, then you are no longer offered the option of classes or interscholastic activities at the public education level.
I don't believe that it applies to classes. It applies to interscholastic activities, OSAA activities only. I believe that schools can provide access to their classes under their own rules.
And currently you're not required to be tested, that the public school system, that isn't part of the process that they require for you to participate in classes through the public school system.
My understanding is if you are a registered homeschooler, then schools can have you enrolled less than part-time, and you are not necessarily subject to the state Oregon state assessments.
But currently you're required to be assessed by the state. That's my point.
No, we're not assessed by the state. We take something completely different. We take a nationally normed standardized test four times. That is not the Oregon state assessment.
But I think the point that I'm trying to make, I'm sorry if I'm not doing a very good job.
Dahlin might be able to help you with your
question. Let me explain what happens. It happened in the schools I'm familiar with, Central Lynn, Yonkala, and even earlier. The outreach was to homeschoolers to draw them in. And you wanted to draw the homeschoolers in, and we had the annual meeting, and I had some very dear friends in that group. And the question always was, what can we do that will provide service to you? And our reasoning was 25,000 students is a savings to the state of Oregon, but it's a loss to the school district. If we can get those kids in and get them to participate in any class, we can count them as part of the ADM. So I don't think the homeschoolers were... There were some that certainly came and wanted to participate in band and music mostly, but we were always struggling to try and offer a program that might meet their needs. So the shoe was really most of the time on the other foot.
May I follow up then, Madam Chair? So then, Representative Dahlin, perhaps you're the one I'm addressing this question to, but then was there not a requirement that the state had for assessment? I mean, if public school children are required to be assessed, then wouldn't homeschool children who are taking classes in the public school system be required?
Usually, and several examples come to mind, and as I follow the chronology that's listed here, usually the type of participation was not in the academic disciplines, but in the co-curricular and extracurricular disciplines, athletics, music, one-time drama, and I remember a few times in the vocational classes, wood shop, not those areas where the school normally tested. And in 25 years, I can't remember one that wanted into one of those classes.
Representative Roblin.
Along the same line. Actually, that's outside the preview of this anyway, because it's only from 7 to 15. I mean, the state law requires them to go to the 8th grade or 16 years old, and it's usually the 8th grade that'll be sooner. And so in high school, they aren't required right now to... I don't even know if they can require you to do the test from the high school level. I mean, they may do that at this point, but the reality is you don't have to be homeschooled or schooled after the 8th grade. That's part of that other law, the Supreme Court ruling. Is that my, is that your understanding as well?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, it's my understanding compulsory attendance is from the age of 7 to 18.
With, okay.
And so we have to submit to the testing and so on and notification up through the time that they're 18.
There is a proviso that would allow you to request not to be in school at the age, finishing of the 8th grade or 16 years of age as well, correct?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, it's not one that we currently pursue and take advantage of, and we might want to follow that.
I do know that that's true.
Chair Flores, can I add one more thing? 26 states and the District of Columbia require no state substantive oversight of home education. 24 states, including Oregon, have some substantive oversight. So the majority of states in this country do not require the state to review how the child is doing. And if a homeschooler wishes to have more oversight than that, there are 24 states that can provide it.
Representative Roblin.
This bill will, in fact, remove compulsory attendance from the state of Oregon. I mean, it doesn't address that particular part of the ORSs, but in a sense, what happens here is compulsory attendance in Oregon will be gone. The case that took place, the Supreme Court has said that there is an interest, but if we pass this bill, that interest will have actually been gone. Is that correct, in your opinion?
Chair Flores and Representative Roblin, no, I don't believe it is. It says that children who are educated at home by their parents or at the direction of their parents are exempt from attending public school. That is not saying that that there is no compulsory attendance. They have to be educated by their parents. Just like in about 12 states, there is no substantive or procedural oversight. There is no reporting by homeschoolers. Is compulsory attendance gone? Do you have a rash of truants there? No, you don't. It's what it says is if you're educated at home, then you don't have to be in school.
Short follow-up. We do have three other people, and we're running out of time.
Yes. No definition of education, what that means, correct? And there's no testing, so there would be no definition of what it means to be educated at home. So if a student, if a parent chose to, and I'm going to tell you, I know very few homeschoolers that I don't appreciate or the family, so, but I am getting to that other part. And so if there is no definition of what education is at home, and there is no requirement to go with the ESD or do anything else, then what in effect, a person, all they have to do is say, I'm homeschooling, and end of compulsory attendance for that particular child. Is that true?
Chair Flores and Representative Roblin, one way that some states address that is to say that the child must receive an education in certain subjects, but it doesn't define the content. So if that is a significant concern, that would be a possibility to say a child must receive instruction in language arts and mathematics or you know, whatever the concern is.
But not addressed in this bill.
It is not currently addressed, no.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call Roger Williams, Dr. Brian Ray, and Jean Biggerstaff. If you could all three come forward, and we'll go through. As I mentioned, we're going into overtime now, so I'm going to ask you to laser focus your comments, and I really apologize that we have to do this, but it will help us get to the substance and critical points of your testimony.
Thank you, Sam.
Flores and Committee. My name is Roger Williams. For the record, I'm the legislative coordinator for Coalition Network. And the irony is they've chosen someone who is the worst speaker in Oregon to be that, and you will have to put up with that. I'm sorry. I'm going to step you through this article, and I'm going to do something which may seem insane. I'm going to point out how good homeschooling test scores are, and then I'm going to tell you that it's not, that it doesn't do the state a hill of beans to know that. This chart. These are test results by score range. Low down at this end, high up at this range, up at this end. The gray bars are what the test publishers go to a lot of trouble to say is normal. The normal number of students expected to score in that range. And they go to a lot of trouble to make sure that 1% of the students will fall in one percentile range. And that's why the gray bars are level. That's just an artifact of how the scoring is done. If the test publishers didn't do that, then they couldn't sell their tests. So it's critical that they get that right. The black bars are the scores, how many homeschool students score in each of those ranges. And you'll notice that very few score at the low end, and a lot, correspondingly many more, score at the high end. And it's kind of a smooth curve. I'd like you to notice that in this lowest range, oh, and by the way, the lowest, they're normally in increments of 10, so 21st to 30th percentile, 51st to 60th percentile. The lowest one here is 1 to 15, and that's because Oregon has a cutoff at the 15th percentile. So that's why I chose up there. Notice that there are only one-third the number of home-educated students in the low end that you would expect. And we can ask, what happened to them? What happened to the other two-thirds? Well, apparently, they scored in a higher range. And they all didn't score, like, in the next range up, because if they would have done that, then it would have overflowed the next range. And in the 16 to 20, am I confusing you yet?
No.
Okay. This is part of my insane picture explaining. And what actually happens, if you look at it, it appears that these students are kind of bumped up into the next higher ranges until you get a huge amount at the high end. Now, is that clear how the chart portrays that? Okay. One feature of this is apparent. The boost in achievement occurs no matter what level the children would have started out at. And in particular, it occurs at the lowest end. No matter where the child starts, it appears that homeschooling is boosting them into a higher bracket, including the lowest end. Now, what factors might account for this? Well, I can think of three. One possibility is that those families who home educate are genetically superior than the general population. Unfortunately, I have to tell you that anybody who knows other homeschoolers and why they originally started homeschooling would have to just write that off as a possible hypothesis.
We don't get to vote on this, 1, 2, or 3.
No, not yet. Another factor possible is demographic factors, income level, parents, education, minority status, like that. And to some extent that probably affects these, but the national research that Dr. Ray has done indicates that those types of factors don't really influence the outcomes very much. So parents with low education and parents with high education are fairly close in how their homeschool kids score. And the third possibility, I really hated throwing out genetics. The third possibility is there's one factor that's universally true for all these students. Their families have decided to provide a home education for them, and they have not been forced back into the public schools by government intervention. The commitment to home education is the only apparent explanation for the benefits these students receive. It is not even dependent on particular teaching techniques, as similar results happen in families who rely on textbooks and workbooks with a lot of structure, and in those at the other end of the spectrum who use a more relaxed approach. The individual attention paid to each student is the one common factor. Interestingly, parents actually change because of the home education process, and any parent, home educating parent in here can tell you this, because they become more focused on their children's education, and this new parental dedication is another plus factor for the student. Please listen to this one carefully because it's absolutely true. There is no known evidence that these students would do just as well in public school when, in fact, their parents are committed to homeschooling. Then there's none. Now, the second chart is drawn from a large national study done by Dr. Ray and the National Home Education Research Institute. This was, a large sample of about 5,400 students nationwide, which most statisticians would give their eye teeth for. And if you'll notice, the same pattern, I just used his numbers for, he was comparing scores from low control states, moderate control states, and high control states. And I believe you said we were moderate control in that. The curve is essentially the same. You see that the structure is the same. And what that is, doing is showing both the Oregon data and the national data are reflecting the same underlying reality of home education effectiveness. And the closely intertwined lines there, I'm sorry that the viewing audience can't see this, make it clear that government regulation makes no appreciable difference in education outcomes for home educated students, and this is true for students at all academic levels, in particular the low end. Now there's some implications for public policy here. First, there's no statistical data suggesting state regulation of home education academically benefits home-educated students. As Mrs. Grant said about her son, and I would say about my son, the anecdotal evidence of what's being translated as is our personal experience and of those that we have observed in the homeschooling community suggests that such regulation actually harms the education of many home-educated students by forcing parents to misdirect their teaching energies into meeting state requirements rather than concentrating on what is best for the individual student's long-term educational good. So regulation of home education should be reduced or eliminated. And the other implication for public policy applies specifically here to Oregon, because Oregon still has a regulation in place to identify lower-achieving homeschool students through testing. The assumption is that these students may be educationally neglected. Test scores, by their nature, cannot indicate that a student would be better off in the public school system, which is the remedy in the Oregon law. Likewise, test scores are unsuited for establishing educational neglect due to individual differences in student learning progressions. And as has been brought before, the way to actually deal with neglect is to follow up on the causes of neglect, dysfunctional families, drug abuse, etc. And these are best identified by social services and law enforcement processes, not by test scores. The data indicate that home education is of benefit to students at all achievement levels, including the low end. So this high-stakes testing to identify low scores is pointless at best, and it causes unnecessary strain on many families. Mandatory testing should be eliminated as a way to regulate home educators. And if the legislature is going to do anything to help home educators educate their children, it will be to eliminate mandatory testing. It's pointless, and it hurts lots of kids.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Dr. Ray and Ms. Biggerstaff, with due apologies, I'm being reminded that we have a committee coming in behind us, so we have to turn the room shortly. So I this is one of the difficult positions of trying to let everyone have their say, so I will.
Madam Chair and committee, thank you very much. My name is Brian Ray. I'm a resident of Oregon. I earned my PhD in science education from Oregon State University, my master's in zoology from Ohio University. I've been a professor at the undergraduate and graduate university levels in Oregon and Washington. I've been a professor of science and education. I've taught teachers. I've served as a certified teacher in classroom schools in both Oregon and Washington. I've been doing research on homeschooling for about 22 years, and I've testified in about 30 courts of law and several state legislatures across the United States. Roger's done a very good job of summarizing research, including mine, so I'll try to zip over that. But the fact of the matter is, most of you have heard this and have seen reports that homeschooled children score on average 15 to 30 percentile points above the national public school average consistently, study after study. In the socialization area, the psychological emotional development, study after study shows they're doing as well, typically better than those in public schools. When you get into the questions of the real world, research by others and myself, a new nationwide study shows that actually as they become adults, they're more involved in local community service, civic activities such as voting, boycotting, writing letters to you, and so forth. So the research is very clear that something's working somewhere. Now, I know most people would nod and say, yeah, I know that. I've heard some of you already talk about those kinds of things. The design, and I have to say this real point blank, the design and content of the current law, even though it is something that home educators strove for years ago, is actually fundamentally flawed. The use of standardized tests for these purposes would not pass muster in many courts of law, nor would they pass muster with the American Psychological Association, American Educational Research Association, and National Center for Measurement and Evaluation standards that I use in courts of law and I use in my research. It's the entire concept of what several states, including Oregon, tries to do with homeschoolers is fundamentally, fatally flawed. And it's just something probably that homeschoolers accepted as a compromise years ago to be able to get the state to recognize parental authority and freedom in the education of children. The research that I've done, and this is something that Roger Williams mentioned, but I should tell you that I've done has shown, and this is a key point to this whole argument, there is not even a correlational relationship between state control of home education and children's learning. If there is not even a correlational, in other words, as A goes up, B goes up, if there's not even a correlational relationship, then no one can argue for a causal relationship. If you don't get anything else out of my presentation, you've got to get that. Therefore, what is going on? The professional standards of social science, educational, psychological research and measurement would say that if you have no relationship, not even a correlation, and you have tenuous arguments, you should not be trying to make significant decisions over a person's life with no data. One of my colleagues calls it data-free. There's no evidence. There is zero evidence that the state should be controlling private home education in the homes of families in America. Anecdotes, little stories here and there by a teacher's union representative, a public school advocate, do not make for good research, nor do they make for good empirical bases for law. The burden of proof in any court of law would be on those who want to maintain state control of homeschooling or increase it. The burden of proof, the whole burden of proof now, empirically, and I would say philosophically, in a free nation like the United States, is on those who want to maintain control of private education in the form of homeschooling. I've seen this in many legislatures, and I'm going to skip the constitutional business because others have done a good job on that. I've seen teachers' unions, some state education officials, social workers oppose bills like House Bill 2733. And I'll have to be honest, I've talked to them. I've seen it in reports. I've seen it in research. Bluntly, it means a loss of revenue. let's face it, there are school districts in both Oregon and other nations who are doing all that they can to try to get homeschool families to put their children into public schools. And I will paraphrase Professor Rob Reese from Stanford University, homeschool/homeschool-, public school connections are an essential element in getting children involved in the public school system. And we've just got to be honest about this. The laws like the current Oregon homeschool law are essentially philosophy-based, preemptive dragnets that are attempts to somehow uncover probable or potential, in the minds of some people, child neglectors or child abusers. And I'm appalled, as a person involved in education in America, to think that we have come to the point where people will actually try to use compulsory school or education laws, which are supposed to be about math, reading, writing, history, and science, to try to preemptively dig out or root out child abusers and child neglectors. I think it's a sad day in America if that's what we've come to. It is. Finally, I'll just say a few real summarized points here. A law like 2733 recognizes the final and primary authority of parents over the education of children. I thought it was just excellent that a testimony from the Oregon Education Association, a teachers union, admitted that perhaps the argument is for increased regulation and control of Catholic schools, Lutheran schools, New Age schools, agnostic private schools, Mormon schools, and Muslim schools. Essentially, people are finally admitting, those who are opposed to parental liberty and education are admitting that what they think is a priori, it is, and actually I heard her and others say, the state's parents, the state's children, they're admitting the real thinking behind this. My understanding of a free nation, and I just got back from Europe where I talked to people who are promoting parental liberty in 7 Eastern and Western European nations who have, as you know, some histories of tyranny that we hope we never have in America. The basic concept is that the state is there to punish an evildoer if he is found, not to try to provide a maternalistic proviso for health, education, and welfare, preemptively dragnetting for people who might do bad. And I would suggest that the evidence empirically and philosophically in a free nation says that a bill like 2733 recognizes that the research is there that shows parents, on average, do well. The research is also there that the control does no good to catch these parents and to improve the learning of their children. So I think it should be passed.
Thank you. Ms. Dickerson?
Okay. Just a quick little statement.
Okay.
I worry at times because it happens on the floor, and I want to, you know, talk to people. Talking about other people's motives and testimony isn't a great thing to do, and I get worried about that when people try to say, you know, the Oregon Education Association's statements and speaking for them. And that kind of stuff. So I worry about that a little bit. I appreciate your testimony, but I get concerned when people try to attribute other people's ideas about that instead of just speaking about what their ideas are. So that's just
Thank you for your thought.
Chair Flores and committee members, for the record, my name is Jean Biggerstaff, and I'm on the board of the Oregon Home Education Network, or OHEN. I'm also a longtime homeschooling parent of a 16-year-old son. I'm really here just to kind of summarize, and I wanted really badly to address Representative Farr's confusion about the interscholastic issue versus classes. Do I need to explain that for anybody? I felt like maybe it wasn't completely understood, but I thought maybe she was the
you
one
know,
who didn't.
You know, you might prepare, if you would like to prepare something
for her,
and then send it to us, and we can
okay.
make sure that we all have it.
Yeah. Okay. I'd just like to kind of finally say to everyone here today that I really believe that this issue is not, sometimes it gets couched as an us versus them issue, or it comes across that way because we feel very passionately about what we do. And we share a commitment with all educators for children to be educated. And I think the bottom line for us with this law, because it does affect, you know, the testing and the reporting, is that we'd just like you to walk away with this thought that no educational system of any kind, public, private, provides 100% guarantee of success. It can't happen. We're human. Okay? And years of oversight and testing by governmental bodies has not resulted in a 100% success rate, and it never will. And I don't care if it's at public or private level, whatever you're talking about. But what we're really talking about is commitment to our children and providing the best education possible with educational choice and the freedom to choose, for the freedom to educate our children the way we think is appropriate. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. We have 2.5 minutes for questions. Representative Roblin.
Thank you very much. Have you seen data aligned the same way you did with your graphs regarding students in public education whose parents were involved? Parent involvement has been consistently the number one key indicator of student success, whether it be homeschool or otherwise. And I would contend that part of that research would back up your research, that it is parent involvement.
Chair Flores, Representative Roland, and that's exactly the point. Homeschooling is the ultimate parental involvement. And you don't want, I don't think the state wants to be in the business of interfering with that process. And that's what the current law does. It sounds innocuous. You go in for a test once every 3 years. You know, so what? Well, in my family's case, we had to teach the test. And we poured our energies into my son to keep him above the 15th percentile. And he's since come up. He's the last one that I remember was up in the 60th, 70th percentile. So, and by the way, 15th percentile sounds low. There's seven of you up there. One out of seven of you would flunk. That's what the 15th percentile is. So it's not a low thing. But I was trying.
Now that opens up a whole new discussion.
Right. Follow up on that one. I will acknowledge being the one. I was a dyslexic kid too. So I truly understand, especially early on, what those issues are. But the question that I would have then is posed this way, and any one of you can answer it. I tend to agree. I don't think that we use testing in this particular way, for the purpose behind, from my perspective, what I am concerned about. So, would you look at or entertain the idea of developing and giving to some person in the state your educational plan for your child? Not that we would evaluate the educational plan, but that there is a plan, talking about English and math and so on. I mean, I would like to know that there is a plan for those kids, because I do know some homeschool situations where I've had to deal with it because homeschoolers pointed out to me that, you know, this person's not doing anything for their child. If it's not the test, what would you say is a reasonable expectation of the state in making sure that there's some plan available for that child?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, your question goes back, I think, you know, to the fundamental question. It's a philosophical issue. And to answer your question with a plan would basically admit that philosophically the state has prior and final authority of the education of a child. Somebody gave you examples earlier. The state of Oklahoma says a child must be schooled or educated otherwise. Oklahoma, understanding the history of the United States, got it right. In other words, the Oregon Constitution says that the state must provide a system of common schools. It does not say that legislators must decide how to make sure children get educated. First of all, because people know you can't make children get educated. Second of all, people knew then, that the state does not have the a priori authority over children's education like Plato wanted. And there's a fundamental philosophical problem there. And so the assumption is parents love their children, they do what's best for them. Then if a neighbor or a public school principal or a private school principal, whether the child's in private or home education, thinks that there's neglect or abuse going on, he's reported, the parent goes through due process, and if it's in fact happening, he's punished.
Can I say 30 seconds on that?
Sure.
It's a matter of trade-offs. You want to protect the kids that are educationally neglected, but you don't want to hurt the kids that the much larger group, even maybe 10%, in order to do that. And that's the trade-off. If Mrs. Grant had an educational plan that said, I think it was third grade, ancient Egypt, and we're skipping, you know, whatever fundamental thing was in the state's agenda, the state would freak out. You can't do that. And that's exactly what this is all about.
I am going to suggest, and I know there's a lot more discussion that needs to be had. We will have another public hearing on this, and if any of you or all of you would like to come back in order to facilitate the further discussion, certainly watch the postings, because we would encourage that and like to have that. So because of now they have 45 seconds to turn this room, I'm very, very apologetic that we had to cut it short. Thank you very much for your time today. We will close
the public hearing
on House Bill 2733, and we will adjourn the committee. Thank you.